discussing the politics of the new European populism, Pella Nuroth-Taylor, on today's News Talk, TNT.
We've got four excellent guests. We've got Rick Walker, a Canadian journalist, formerly with CTV News. He's going to talk us about the Canadian election and the various acts of tyranny by the surfer dude Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Our second guest is Pierre Billon, a PhD and senior fellow of the Mises Institute and associate professor of entrepreneurship at the Spears School of Business. And he's going to tell us about the freedoms offered by AI. But I'm going to give some pushback and talk about some of the issues there. They're quite controversial because it's going to put a lot of people out of work. We've got in the second hour, we've got Joe Hoft, who's well known to TNT viewers. He's hosting the Jason Berman show this week, and he's going to talk to us about election stealing, which is a restriction on people's freedom to vote who they want to, if what the guy they vote for doesn't get elected. And finally, we've got Gerard Felitti, and the final guest in our second hour is a senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. He's going to give us an update on the various Lawfare efforts to prevent Trump from being the democratically elected and chosen candidate for the American people. I just want to say a little bit about what's going on in Europe, since we're based in Europe after all. There are two things that are going against freedom in Europe at the moment that have been highlighted in the European media. One is kind of pre-dawn arrests by people protesting against the Israeli mass casualties, come genocide events in Gaza. The Germans are very sensitive about that because they say that talking about what's happening in Palestine as a Holocaust attacks there the right of the Israelis and the Jews to be the unique victims of the Jewish Holocaust perpetrated mainly by Germany. So in France, meanwhile, there's been attacks against the leader of the French party, leading French left-wing party, my sources in France are saying that there's a huge restriction on the pro-Palestinian or anti-Israeli genocide movement. Meanwhile, in Britain, there's a very interesting article here talking about the expansion of AI generated surveillance of people. You have people on these watch lists, which are growing ever more expansively. UK was the long been known as the CCTV capital of the world, as a country that's uniting together with the other Anglosphere countries to fight against the axis of authoritarianism, you know, echoes of axis of evil back in 2002, China, Iran, and Russia. Meanwhile, the European Union's landmark AI Act, it has nothing on what's going on in Britain. So the House magazine of Brussels, Politico, sneers at Britain, you know, it did its Brexit thing to get away from the European continentals and their vos papiers, s'il vous plaît mentality. But of course, we've got, this article says that campaigners, experts, and PSA, the UK is fast becoming an outlier among democracy in the pace at which it's adopting live facial recognition technology in the absence of firm legal underpinnings. Some British lawmakers even fear that the country could be hurtling towards a future where the movements of entire populations could be tracked in real time by authorities with minimal oversight. But the British Home Office is undeterred now. And then it cites some experts from the various sort of NGOs worried about privacy saying, they haven't listened to them and the Conservative Party government is forging ahead with this sort of minority report type surveillance society, where not just convicted criminals are on the watch list, but a lot of people could be on the watch list. And of course, it's this eternal trade-off between preventing crime and intruding on people's privacy. And it's interesting, I did a deep dive this morning into a survey on freedom. There's a really good website called futurefreespeech.org. Really look it up because they've got a fantastic paper there on the different aspects of free speech, because different countries worry about different things. And although the Brits and the Scandinavians and the Swedes, and the Americans probably rate freedom as the highest value, and the continentals are a little bit behind in practical effects. Whilst the UK supports burning the Union Jack, for instance, there's rather lowish support for criticizing pandemic measures, and even lower support, the lowest on the list of about 30 countries, which include Mexico and Venezuela, for criticizing issues relating to national security. Even Russia's much higher than there. And the UK is also the lowest in support of an unrestrained social media of all countries listed, whereas US and Sweden and Scandinavia have a very, very high tolerance for an unrestricted social media. So it's a question of the chicken and the egg. Is it the British public that does support a relatively authoritarian social climate, or is it the propaganda that makes the British think like this, which then feeds back into the democratic policy that allows politicians to be restrictive? Anyways, we're going to go into our first news analysis of Basil Valentine, our political editor, and we'll have more on freedom in our second hour monologue. Okay, we're going to go for a quick break, and then we've got Basil Valentine, our political editor.
Giving you what you want.
I want the facts.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good afternoon, Basil. How are you, our political editor?
I'm very well, thank you, Pelly. It's great to be with you, and hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world.
What is in the news today?
Well, the issue of freedom and freedom of speech and assembly in particular, with reference to the anti-genocide protests dotted across university campuses all the way over America. Police have arrested hundreds more protesters in different locations. 108 arrests were made at Emerson College, Boston, 93 people at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Protesters and police also clashed at the University of Texas in Austin. And of course, yesterday, House Speaker Mike Johnson went to Columbia University in New York and made a ludicrous, you know, frankly, idiotic speech about the virus of anti-Semitism. Governor Greg Abbott of Texas made similar remarks when sending in the Texas National Guard on horseback to break up the encampment at universities in his state. It really is bringing into sharp focus two things. First of all, the limits of free speech and freedom of assembly at American universities. These students pay huge amounts of money to attend these schools. And in the past, you know, were they to be demonstrating about some other third party issue, let's say abortion, for example, or some aspect of their teaching, I very much doubt that they would have been mass arrested like this. And secondly, is this deliberate misrepresentation, which I think stems directly from Israel, although it's sort of baked into the mindset of people like Governor Abbott and Speaker Johnson, which is that criticism of genocide is somehow anti-Semitic. They completely ignore the fact that there are hundreds of Jewish protesters amongst the people arrested, as well as those simply objecting. And I saw an interview on Al Jazeera with a Jewish member of faculty at Columbia who said this is all perfectly safe. Mike Johnson was talking some nonsense about Jewish students being in fear of their lives. I mean, this is just off the charts mendacious. It's as simple as that. And Joe Biden has chimed in with it, you know, as if banning TikTok, and that's in the works for all your survey before I came on, was talking about how Americans were tolerant of a completely free social media landscape. Capitol Hill, much less so, under cover of course, this spurious nonsense about it being a vehicle for the Chinese Communist Party. There are moves more than afoot to ban TikTok in the United States, although Carrie and Jean-Pierre at the White House said yesterday that that Biden is not in favor. As if banning social media and violently breaking up student demonstrations is somehow going to make Generation X, Generation Z, and the millennials fall in love with apartheid and genocide. I mean, it really is the most extraordinary crackdown, frankly, against peaceful protest that we've seen in the United States for well over 50 years. You know, people talk about the Vietnam era. This is now every bit as big. It's numerous. You know, all the way across the states, there are these encampments. Yeah. And in an increasing number of cases, they're being violently broken up with mass arrests.
I'm just going to lean into that, because I'll give you the European angle. I found that text. Mathilde Panot is the president of the main left-wing party, LFI, the French parliament, and she was just summoned by Macron's police. She's investigated for apology for terrorism because of our party's opposition to Israel's actions in Gaza. And it's just, she never actually said anything in favor of terrorism. She isn't the first one to be targeted like this in her party, but certainly the highest level one. Just like in Germany, it looks like France is moving towards de facto criminalizing support for Palestinians and criminalizing criticism of Israel. There was this case of the Sciences Po, which is a university in Paris, where a woman denied the story that she was not unable to enter the university. She was Jewish and she was allegedly stopped. But in fact, she's denied that. But it didn't deter the media from dedicating wall-to-wall coverage of Sciences Po's descent into anti-Semitism. And in
That's
Germany...
That's right. There's this endless media misrepresentation of what is going on. With talking heads backing it up on the corporate cable channels and legacy media, Pelle.
It is. And that, well, fortunately, people have got this to go by. We've got what's happening in Germany is even more alarming. It's someone said to me, I don't know if it was this, the new fascism is anti-fascism. So German police are now undertaking dawn raids, confiscating all electronic devices and following up the criminal prosecution for using the word Gaza Holocaust under the pretext that it trivializes the Holocaust committed by earlier Germans staged dawn raids to suppress political dissent.
That is the most extraordinary thing I've heard in a long time.
Yeah, right.
That using the term Gaza Holocaust minimalizes the events of the Second World War. That is absolutely egregious. Countries, of course, like Germany don't have any First Amendment rights, although those, of course, are being discarded rapidly. Greg Abbott, protesters belong in jail. Extraordinary stuff.
Yeah, but and it's funny about this ban of TikTok, just to pivot, because TikTok is, if anything, I mean, it's pacifizing. I mean, if you had a population addicted to TikTok, they wouldn't go out and protest, because it's mostly, I've guiltily watched it a couple of times, and it's like a sort of a total brainwashing sort of pacifizing, you know, tips about good dates. It's aimed at an audience of about 22 years old, you know, and bungee jumping into canyons, and skydiving, and good, nice recipes, things to do with baking soda and Coca-Cola if you combine the two. I haven't seen any politics, and given my interest, they auto select for politics, but nothing at all. Biden would be much wiser to ban X if he was really interested in censoring people. Anyway,
there's no chance of banning X, touch wood, for the time being. But
it's because all politicians are on it, I
guess.
You're
obviously not
it?
Part of the right networks on TikTok. The whole point of it is, and the Jonathan Greenblatt, the director of the so-called Anti-Defamation League, has been caught on tape saying that, you know, Israel has this huge generational problem with younger people. Who knew? Deciding that they don't like apartheid and genocide. That social media is one of the things that's fueling it, because they're sharing clips of the atrocities in Gaza with each other. And that's the whole point. Just to bring us up to date, the encampment protests are literally spreading like wildfire. George Washington University today, Cornell University in Ithaca. Just today, students have created a liberated zone on the campus to pressure the university administration to divest from genocide in Gaza. Princeton University president says the encampments violate the policies there. 108 arrested in protests around Emerson College. Now, the problem the universities have got is, of course, that most of them take huge donations from assorted Zionist billionaires.
Basil, sorry, we've got to wind up because we've got our first guest waiting, but excitement in the air as this spring of 2024 continues. All right, thanks a lot, Basil. We'll have you on in the next hour. Back to our guest interviews. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
TNT's Joseph Arthur.
I wonder if you can simplify sort of the different components of the war that we're in, how it's working, what the motivation is.
The bottom line is nitrogenous fertilizers are one of the main engines, and those are being interrupted. And that's why I went to BASF twice before Nord Stream was cut, because I suspected they were going to cut Nord Stream. So I was there with Misako Gunaha at BASF, and I asked somebody inside the plant. It's a 10 square kilometer plant, right? And so I asked him, what happens if Nord Stream is interrupted? This was before it was interrupted. He said, we are dead. Well, now it's gone. It's been destroyed, right? And I predicted that publicly.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk, TNT.
TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT is become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission. So many people who had no history of heart illnesses have got it now, or blood clotting after the COVID-19 vaccination. Punish those who hurt people with COVID madness, lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelinero's Taylor Show on this Thursday afternoon. We've got Rick Walker with us. He's a Canadian journalist, formerly with CTV News for 25 years, currently with Maverick Multimedia, a CEO and executive producer, and a host of the Maverick News every night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Welcome to the show, Rick.
My privilege. Thank you for having me today. Great to meet you.
We were just talking about freedom in the Anglosphere as my monologue, and The Brits are more in favor of CCTV and less in favor of debate, open debates about security issues. And for that matter, I didn't have a chance to mention it in my talk about criticizing, you know, ethnic minorities. And that comes as a surprise, because a lot of people voting for Brexit in Britain thought, well, we'll get away from those pesky continentals and their, you know, have you got your documents on you mentality. It turns out the British are not much in favor of freedom as they think. Is it the same in Canada? We get also an Anglosphere country where freedom seems to be in the worst state in any of the English speaking countries. Is that true?
I think that you've touched on something very important there. You know, I just came back from Costa Rica, and as I was coming through the airport, they had facial recognition scanners for the first time in my lifetime set up, and people just, you know, walking through the turnstiles, just willingly accepting it. There is an element, a growing portion of society that is increasingly concerned about it. But people are, I think, surprisingly complacent and accepting of these things.
Mm. I mean, some people say that the Americans, unfortunately, this poll of 30 countries ranks the United States, normal people, not the Congress, as being very, very in favor of freedom, more than the Brits or the Swedes or anyone else. But the reputation Canada has is it's more egalitarian, more progressive, whatever, more in favor of socialized healthcare and so on. But they're not as interested in freedom. Is that true? Is that a libel against the Canadians? Because it is also ranked as one of the freest countries in the world. So maybe this is just splitting hairs.
I think that you have a very split population right now. The progressive left is increasingly accepting of more authoritarianism. And then you have, the more conservative elements out there trying to preserve what freedom we have left. And this next election coming up federally in Canada, I think will be fought very much on the issues of freedom. In fact, you have the conservative leader opposing Justin Trudeau, Pierre Poilievre, saying that he wants to make Canada the freest nation on earth. While you have really the poster boy for the World Economic Forum, Justin Trudeau, on the other side. So we've got a real battle brewing.
Well, it's interesting that it might be an election worth sort of voting in, or it'll get a lot of people. I mean, Jordan Peterson is a huge profile in Europe, so people know much more about Canadian politics than they might otherwise do. Well, that does lead us into the sort of nitty-gritty of Canadian politics, because the election is next year, right?
It has to be. With the way the parliamentary system works, it could go, you know, they could call an election sooner, but constitutionally, he's required to call an election by October of next year.
So this guy, this opposition leader, is a bit of a guy who stands up for freedom. I saw Poilievre. He was at some event yesterday, which got the left upset because he was he photographed next to a sign that could be construed as far right or something? Fill me in.
Yes, yes. It was a milestone moment to be sure. I think that there's some strategy unfolding here, and there's more going on behind the scenes than people realize. But I mean, I don't want to be conspiratorial about all of this stuff. But yes, what you have is sort of the people who have been involved in the freedom movement, which goes back to that freedom convoy that we saw in Ottawa, which was, you know, history making. Pierre Poilievre is sort of, I think, reaching out to that group of people, trying to bring the conservative elements of that into his arena. He wants that support. He needs to unite the right again, which has been fractured in Canada, in order to defeat Trudeau. So he's latching onto that. But there is an element that is viewed as far right in Canada. And specifically, there's this online group called Diagalon, which is portrayed by the group itself as being nothing more than a meme, and sort of a joke in a community of people. People on the left say that it's an accelerationist, far right, white supremacist group. So you can draw your own conclusions based on whatever evidence you want to bring to the table. But yeah, Poilievre, you know, there was a moment where he's walking out of a trailer at this protest site, because they have these protests right now set up across the country to protest the carbon tax. So he stopped at one just randomly on the weekend. But as he's walking out of the trailer, there's this flag for the Diagalon group drawn on the door of the trailer. So, of course, that was the photo moment for the left. They're like, aha, you see, he's romancing with the left, or sorry, with the far right. He's right there with that Diagalon flag. And so Justin Trudeau yesterday latched onto that and then made comment on it in a news conference, used it as ammunition.
Yeah, I mean, this thing about carbon tax, Canada, of course, has enormous resources, and you're using, how is the environmental issue playing out and the climate issue? Because God knows you could probably do with warmer winters, you know.
Yes, it's fracturing the country. Alberta being the oil-rich province in Canada, it's one of the economic drivers for the country. But Trudeau, the progressive left, they've declared war basically on the oil industry, and they're not letting Alberta extract oil to its maximum benefit for the people of Alberta. They've shut much of the oil industry down here. So meanwhile, we're importing oil from the Middle East, not using the resources that we have here domestically. And people out in Western Canada, in Alberta, are particularly upset about it. And it is fueling separatist political parties. And so, I mean, people know that Quebec historically has been a province that sort of wants to separate from Canada, but you have, I would say, even more of that out in Western Canada right now, which has been there for a long time, but now really amped up.
Okay. Rick, we're just going to go into a quick news summary, but we'll be back and talking about Canadian politics and the election coming up. It could be this autumn or next year. We don't know. Thanks a lot. This is the Pelinero Taylor Show. Into a quick news break.
I got a news flash for you.
News flash!
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with your TNT headlines. Tensions over Israel's war in Gaza have flared in America, with riot police clashing with students at colleges and universities across the country. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has responded to the uprising, demanding authorities do more to shut it down.
What's happening on America's college campuses is horrific.
And it's been revealed the US secretly shipped a batch of long-range missiles to Ukraine, which have been used to strike a Russian airfield.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the show. We were just talking here. Sweden and Canada, I mean, I'm located in Sweden. My connection to Canada through my British half is all to do with Commonwealth and common language and so on. But Sweden also has a connection to Canada in the sense that these two countries have been lumped together as progressive, cold countries that are at peace and have high taxes and are very liberal. And I guess it sort of started when in the 1970s, when Pierre Trudeau was quite well known in Sweden. And the Swedish Prime Minister at the time, Olof Palme, they were supposed to be friends. And I don't know if they coordinated their policies. But I think that certainly in terms of immigration policy and multiculturalism policy, Sweden was very homogeneous and never an immigration country. The world's oldest nation state or something, very white. Canada never had that history because it was an immigration society. I mean, French and Brits and then Native Indians. But I think that the Swedes looked a lot at Canada when they were embarking on their multiculturalism project. And it wrote into the constitution as long as ago as 1975. And now Sweden, of course, you can no longer say that Sweden is a white country. It's another country. So we're going to talk a little bit about that because Canada, of course, is run by Justin Trudeau's son. I looked up a little bit about Margaret Trudeau, the beautiful wife of Pierre Trudeau. And Justin Trudeau's offspring. And Justin Trudeau has made immigration a big thing in his policy, hasn't it, in his political makeup. So tell us about immigration in Canada and how that's changed in the last decade or so, 20 years.
It's been transformative. He has fundamentally changed the country. You speak to even new Canadians, and they'll say that they don't recognize Canada anymore. It is because the demographics have changed so much. We have record levels of immigration happening right now. Canada, just you go back even before Trudeau, just before Trudeau, 8-9 years ago, it was a country of 30 million people. Not a really big country population-wise, huge landmass, but within just during the reign of Trudeau, we've now just topped 40 million people. And that is because of immigration. Record levels, massive waves of new people coming in, and over a million people coming in scheduled, I think, again for this year in just 1 year. That's a lot for a country of just now 40 million people.
Mm. I mean, the thing is about ditto with Sweden. Sweden's taking in 150,000 a year or something, but of course, it's only got a population of 10 million. And as long as if Sweden and Canada don't have the territory, it's that the populations are quite small, so that the transformation has a big effect. And of course, the northern half of Sweden is underpopulated because of the cold weather. And ditto Canada. I mean, can Canada cope with this? Because they said that Canada. America had this strongly assimilationist mentality, and you all strong constitution and so on. And Canada went more into multiculturalism, and you could afford it because you were not so ethnically, what's the word? You were less ethnically, more ethnically cohesive than the United States. So what is it called? The salad bowl or something?
Canada. So in the melting States, pot, they would call it a melting pot, and in Canada, they would call it a cultural mosaic.
Right. So can Canada, because what have you got? You all strung out along the border with America, your entire population, one of the world's largest countries. You know, what unites Canada? Can you cope? How is that? You know, what is it that, what does Canadian mean? Do people subscribe to this idea of this new idea of Canada?
You know what? Justin Trudeau says Canada has no actual identity. He says it is the world's first post-national state. Canada is on the cutting edge of this of globalism, and he has been pushing that. That's what the liberal progressive government that we have has been all about. That's why so many people are upset. That's why the country is so disrupted right now. It's fractured. It's in a terrible state, and because of the massive waves of immigration, I'm just talking about the sheer numbers of people. The systems are under extreme stress, whether it's healthcare or housing or, you know, any schooling, all the school system, we're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. I mean, because you've got this ditto. I mean, what's happened in Sweden is that the people don't want to pay tax. It had historically very high taxes because people were prepared to pay for their ethnic kin, basically. I mean, that's the raw truth. And now people are trying to dodge their taxes because you've got a very high unemployment rate of the recent migrants because the labor laws make it difficult to get a job if nothing else. And then they don't have the training or the education to get a high-skilled job. So they're out of work and they get benefits. And there's a lot of friction there in Sweden. And I guess it's the same in Canada.
Absolutely. And it's being exacerbated, these problems, because of inflation, the money printing that has gone on, especially since the pandemic and ongoing since then. Housing prices under Justin Trudeau have more than doubled on average across the country. We have a whole generation of people who, young people who are now being told they will probably never be able to afford to buy their own home. And you even have the RCMP coming out with a study that was supposed to be secret. And I think CSIS, which is our version of the CIA, they came out, there was a study that was leaked to the public that shows there's so much disruption, that the country is so disrupted and there's so much economic stress that they're concerned there could be some sort of an uprising or revolt against the government within the next 10 years.
What happened with that trucker's convoy? Because, you know, we saw the headlines, and as one is, even though we distrust the mainstream media for a lot of the lesser things, we forget how distrusted it is. And then we pick up some headlines from it. So that trucker convoy fell off out of the main headlines. What was the resolution of that? And how important was it?
It was extremely important. It was, a core group of people who were dissatisfied with government to begin with. Then the pandemic came along and they created this convoy. The general public, it was just the timing, you know, the lockdowns, the mask mandates, the forced vaccinations. This got the public out in unprecedented numbers to a protest that was all aimed at Justin Trudeau. But as a result of that, you saw the government push back in a very authoritarian way, beating peaceful protesters in the streets. It's undermined trust in government, in our institutions, and our policing. And as a result now, though, you're seeing a lot of pushback and lawsuits happening, because even though there's been a little bit of back and forth in the courts, we did just get a ruling to show that Justin Trudeau's use of what they call the Emergencies Act, it's just the rebranded War Measures Act, to shut that protest down was unconstitutional. And so now all of the people who are arrested, assaulted by police, they now have a legal foundation to launch lawsuits against the government. So you're starting to see that, and it's having some real impact. But what happened on the weekend with the conservative leader stopping at that axe the tax protest, those people involved in those protests across the country, that's the remnants of the Freedom Convoy still in action.
Well, all this is incredibly interesting. I mean, we ought to hear much more about Canada, but unfortunately, the way the news functions is that if it bleeds, it leads, sort of thing. And so far, it hasn't gone so bad. But we'd love to talk to you again. And I'm afraid we're going to wind up there for the moment. But I can highly recommend, if you want to keep up to date with things Canadian, to look up Rick Walker, who's the host of Maverick News every night at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And I guess you can find it on the internet and
Mavericknews.ca, like yes. Mavericknews.ca.
Okay, great to have you on, Rick. We'd love to have you on again soon. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show, and we're going to segue into our next guest of this Thursday afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride with being part of these multi-generational businesses. But there's also a significant amount of pressure. My senior year of high school, my dad made the decision this world no longer needed him in it. I don't know if he was overwhelmed by the bills and checks that weren't going to be coming in because of the strawberries dying off, but it breaks my heart that my dad made a permanent decision for a temporary issue. Don't feel like you have to go through it alone.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
the mornings. That's my time. Watching the sun come up, I can have a cup of coffee and exercise if I want to. It helps me start the day with a sense of gratitude.
Yay!
Every day is a new opportunity. Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind.
Many pollution sources can affect the air you breathe, from power plants and vehicles to dust and wildfires. Knowing more about local air quality can help you protect your health. If you're thinking about buying an air sensor, EPA has a series of videos to help you get the most out of it. Learn how EPA collects and uses regulatory data, how EPA communicates health messaging, and how to interpret the readings from your sensor. Visit epa.gov/air-sensor-toolbox.
From the Cold War to propaganda and the deep state,
Pella Neuroth-Taylor
on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show. We've got Per Bülund, who's an AI expert. He's a senior fellow of the Mises Institute and associate professor of entrepreneurship at Oklahoma, at the Johnny D. Pope Chair at the School of Entrepreneurship in the Spear School of Business at the Oklahoma State University. He's also an associate fellow of the Ratio Institute in Stockholm. And it's very relevant to have him on because we're talking earlier in my monologue about the expansion of facial recognition CCTV cameras in London, which might reduce crime, but are also associated with privacy and integrity issues. Welcome to the show, Per.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're quite sanguine about AI. Can you tell us why it's good for us?
Well, I mean, the short answer is that I'm an economist. The little longer answer is that AI is really technological development, and it's what economists would call capital. So it really makes us more productive, and we can see that in many businesses or lines or professions, really. Where this already has an effect. So say copywriting and translation services, things like that, where AI, the way it is currently done anyway, helps us by simply making us much more productive. And I see this with my students too, which, I mean, this counts as cheating, but they ask the AI to write their essays and things like that. So we can produce content much more quickly and with less effort, which of course means that we get more for our money, and it also means that people can get jobs elsewhere, and we can leave this this type of task to the machines, just like we have done with many other things. I mean, it used to be the case that machines replaced our muscle power, so it replaced manual labor, and now with AI and computers, they replace our mind power in a sense. Not all of it, of course, but they at least take over repetitive tasks, and we should see that as a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to put a lot of people out of work, though. I hate to be a Luddite. I mean, I don't want to go back to the Stone Age or anything. And we'll probably adapt. But it's in the nature of journalists, I guess, because we can't engineer the things ourselves. What we do have is the verbal ability to ask questions and be Pollyannish about it. I mean, there's a lack. The thing is, even corporate lawyers might find themselves out of work, apparently, because AI will be able to scan hundreds of thousands of words at a very short time and be able to summarize things. And hitherto, you know, you've had problems with automation affecting the blue collar class, but now AI is really going to hammer the elites of society. So I guess if the journalists don't provide pushback, the journalists are going to be under threat as well, because they're going to write articles, AI is going to write articles. But corporate lawyers, who are a powerful and noisy lot, they're going to be up in arms, I guess, soon. So what do you say to that? I mean, work is a central function of our lives in the sense that it provides us with identity and meaning. And if are we just going to go and sit and watch TikTok videos while the AI computer does our job for us? What's the solution? I mean, it's deeply, profoundly important for us to have a job.
Yeah, that is true. And I mean, I don't think you're arguing that the world would be worse with less lawyers, but... I think in many types of tasks that people, I mean, when you have a job, you want to continue being in that job, most likely. But it is the nature of things and the nature of the economy that we replace those jobs that can be replaced. And that doesn't mean that we get less jobs, because if that were the case, then the spinning jenny and things like that back hundreds of years ago would have caused a massive unemployment and we would still have massive unemployment. But instead, we have a greater population, much more people working in many more different types of jobs. So that's not really a problem in the long term. I mean, in the short term, however, there's this thing called technological unemployment, where because this is sort of a rapid shift, it makes people lose their jobs and they can't find a new one really quickly. I think in this case, in many of these professions affected by AI, it's not really that much of a problem as we might think it is. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned journalists, for instance, and if it were the case that we were talking about newspapers and news reporting, say 50 or 100 years ago, you had plenty of journalists and they were reporting and they were out there and they were looking at things and writing it up. But today, many newspapers are really just copying and pasting articles from the AP or Reuters. So many of journalists have already been weeded out for efficiency reasons, probably. And what we're going to see now is rather that you can have AI rewrite these articles to fit better your specific target audience. So yes, people will probably lose their jobs. I mean, I don't think there's a way around that. That's a shame. And it's definitely sad and bad for those people. And I'm probably one of them as a teacher at a university. An AI can teach pretty well and probably teach students much better than many professors, and AI never gets tired and so forth. But still, I welcome this because I think this is a means to greater prosperity in the future, if we do it right, I should say.
Yeah. AI is, I was thinking about journalism. I mean, journalism is probably as good as it was before. It's just in different places, like the alternative media and a lot of citizen journalists, whereas the mainstream media seem to be worse than they ever were. But perhaps it's also that we're more aware, so we can find out the mistakes of journalists more easily because we have other sources to go to. But are there any jobs that are AI proof? I mean, should we all become hairdressers or personal assistants or whatever it is that is AI can't do?
Yeah, I mean, that's one big category actually is manual labor, because AI cannot do manual labor. So I mean, this any job that is based on the mind and especially communication in whatever form can be affected by AI. I think in general, this will just make the people who are probably best at their jobs much more productive. I see other problems with AI that are much worse than AI taking over certain tasks. And it's how we as a society respond to this new world, if you will, and also the problems that AI, the way it's currently in its current shape and form, deals with truth, because it has no idea what truth is. So
exactly. Can you expand AI on that? You said they summarized one of your books or something, but they introduced things that you hadn't actually put in your book based on what books of your type usually say. And that's terrible if you wanted to claim ownership of a particular text. And of course, we can't rely on the fact that it'll be not introduce fake news. And if you introduce a fake news virus into the mainstream, as it were, that'll always be there. When the AI picks it up, it'll be hard to root out. But I guess, I mean, that's just me looking as an information analyst. But you've thought of other things maybe that are weak, that AI can cause huge problems. Can you tell me about those?
Yeah, it's exactly right what you say, because AI, I mean, we tend to think of AI as sort of sci-fi type of thing, where it's like HAL in the Space Odyssey or Skynet in Terminator. But this AI that we have today is really a chatbot. It can produce video and images too, but it's really sifting through a lot of text so that it can predict how a human would respond in certain situations. So that's why it's really good at copy editing and in proofreading and changing the tone of a text and things like that. The problem, of course, is that by predicting what a human would sound like, there's also no connection to, and it's not tethered to what is actually true. Instead, it's just summarizing the most common way of expressing themselves. That's a huge problem. I actually use this in teaching, because I, as most people in my line of work, discovered that a lot of students were using AI to cheat and do the work for them. So instead, I have the students use AI and then spot the errors that AI actually includes in whatever AI spits out. And this has to do with what you mentioned, that when I asked the AI to summarize my book, it did it, and the book is available online, so it's easy for it to just scan the PDF and whatever and produce a summary. It produced a very nice summary of the book, but then it added stuff that's usually in this type of book. So in my case, it's an introductory text to economics and how to understand the economy. And it has no math, no graphs, no formulas, no jargon or anything like that. That was on purpose. But the AI added that I was talking about equilibrium and functions and things like that, because that's usually in an economics text. So it was predicting much more than it was actually summarizing, which means that it's really erasing the difference between truth and false. And if we then expect AI to tell the truth and we just use it as sort of a blueprint or a key to what is true, then we're in big trouble. And that of course, goes for anything that AI produces and touches.
And one thing I was, one of the most shocking things about this Gaza war is the fact that the Israelis are using it to bomb people who, using AI recognition. I mean, that's like this film RoboCop, I don't know if you remember, 35 years ago, come true, and then making some assessment, and it's just signed off by some young conscript, needs a human hand. But basically, it's murder by machine and by data analysis based on probability. And they're even culling, apparently, WhatsApp groups and choosing people on the basis of their affiliation with other known terrorists. So just, you didn't have to talk about the Gaza one specifically, but isn't there the danger of warfare, and that ultimately will be end up being nuked, all of us, because of some AI making an instant split second decision based on, you know, probabilities rather than, can you have you thought about those things?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is a problem. I don't think the problem is that AI will have sort of autonomous murder robots running around. I sure hope no one will develop those. But what we have is people putting these abilities in place. And I mean, the Chinese government has done this for a very long time, both facial recognition and such things as gait recognition. So they can figure out who you are by simply letting a camera capture how you walk. Which of course plays very well into their whole social credit score system, so that they can keep tabs on everyone instantaneously. And this might actually be a productive thing too. I mean, technology itself is neither morally good or bad. It's pretty neutral. It's how we use it that matters. And I think that is the great problem with AI, just as it is with any technology, is if it's used for bad and it's used for destruction. So what you mentioned in war, for instance, AI can make these decisions very quickly, and it can kill off people based off of how they're instructed to sort people and kill them off. It can also be used for surveillance and so forth.
You were saying that that there's AI that can determine by the way you walk what sort of person you are. How can you, that's an intriguing little thing. Can you just tell me about that? I mean, because how do they do that? I mean,
it's a matter of pattern matching. AI can very quickly figure out patterns and the way it's used. I mean, it's really a machine learning. So if the more data you feed it, the better it becomes at figuring out who this might be. So if it has a lot of information on how you walk and who you are, maybe you can feed it with health data and things like that too, to just see, well, he has this condition which makes this person walk in different ways. So it can identify people without actually having the actual data, which of course is troublesome. It's not troublesome if you want to say, maybe find a criminal after the fact, or identify who it is if there's been a natural disaster, and figure out who is this and are they sick and how can we best help them. I mean, those things are good, of course, if it's used for the state apparatus to control us and sort of have a real or an implied dictatorship, then of course it's bad.
Okay, I mean, One final thing, which I don't usually think about, but equality, DEI, and all the rest of it. I mean, won't it affect people who's at the bottom level of the of society, and who might include a lot of people from ethnic minorities, and they won't be able to scale up their capabilities to get the kind of jobs that avoid AI monitoring? Do you think that's a problem?
Well, AI. You mean in terms of education and then just learning?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's always a problem with new technology in the beginning, because it's always the case that whoever is most prepared for this new type of revolution, whatever it might be, can gain more, at least in the beginning. But it also creates a demand for and lowers the cost of attaining those capabilities. Mm-hmm. So that might be the case. I mean, what we're seeing today is AI is mostly free online. So whoever has an internet connection can use it and can figure out how to take advantage of it. And in that sense, I mean, I would say it creates equality rather than increases inequality for the simple reason that everybody has access.
I'll only use the example because I'm based here in Sweden. They talked a lot about it, but because Sweden has rather poor integration of its migrants, and everyone says that, even people who want migration. And they've worked out, well, one of the reasons why is that when migrants came in the 1970s, they could walk straight into factory jobs, which didn't require knowledge of Swedish or anything. And now those jobs are not existing anymore. The migrants don't have those immediately applicable skills. But anyway, so what is your proposal then? Should we have some AI council? I'm constitutionally my personality goes against all kinds of restrictions and legislation to pull back innovation, but we've got to do something, have we not?
Well, we have to do something, and we should do a lot, I think. And I think the big problem now that we're going to see, you mentioned unemployment and things like that, is that we're in the midst of really a big technological revolution, and they're not that bad if it is the case that people can start businesses and figure out other opportunities. And I don't mean that anyone who is unemployed because of AI should start their own business, but other people can start businesses too. And especially if they see that people with, say, these journalistic competencies and that sort of experience, they can be used toward other ends, so they can start businesses doing this. So the big problem I see in terms of unemployment is simply that the market is so restricted and so regulated that people will have a hard time starting businesses, and you can't really take a chance on it because it's so costly. So that's one of the big problems that we can definitely do a lot by simply deregulating the market in general.
Deregulation is the first answer. We've got to kind of wind up there. So, Per, can we tell us where we can find your stuff and what we can look forward to in terms of output and your production on this topic in the future? Are you working on any article? You tell us. We've got about a minute left.
Yeah, absolutely. So I write a little now and then at Mises.org, so that will be a place to figure that out. My new book that I mentioned before can be downloaded for free at Mises.org/primer. And other than that, I'm working on a couple of books right now discussing entrepreneurship, since that is my specialization and expertise. So, and I'm very active on X, formerly Twitter, so people can hook me up there too.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Per. So Per Bylund, a senior fellow of the Mises Institute and associate professor of entrepreneurship. He's written three books, and you can find him on PerBylund on X and all the usual other places. Great to have you on. Very worrying, but also a lot of potential there for AI. And it's a debate that's only just begun rather than towards its end. Thank you very much, Per, for helping us navigate through these issues. This is the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on TNT. Back after the news and then.